Greetings in the name of Christ. It's wonderful to be with you again this morning. I do mean that, by the way, consciously. It's been sort of a rocky couple of weeks for us here, and it's just great to be back with you all. Now, unfortunately, I'm here all by myself, again. My family is homesick, again. And I think inevitably, my mind is sort of drawn to that topic. It seems like we've been going through a lot of interesting things God has been putting us through in the last, about 6 weeks, it seems. And you wonder after a while what's going on and what God is trying. Why am I this hard-headed that God has to work on me this long to work whatever he's trying to work in our lives? And I had to think of this thing of allegiance. And we sing this song, "Who is on the Lord's Side?" And I mean, we're on the Lord's side, right? We're God's people. And why are we God's people? Well, we're God's people because, well, why? And is it because we come to church every Sunday, because we belong to this particular congregation, or because we, why can we claim this thing of being God's people? And then I thought of a story that I had in ninth grade literature. And it's one of the stories that stuck with me for a long, long time. And I still think of it every once in a while, and it popped into my mind. And it quotes this rather strange verse over in Philippians. And you know how much I like Philippians. I'm always quoting from Philippians. But in the toward the end of Philippians 4, Paul is saying this to the Philippian church. He's talking to them about how thankful he is that they've helped him out. And he knows it's not been easy for them. Paul's writing this letter from Rome, from prison. And the letter of Philippians is just full of beauty, written from prison. But then he says this in verse 19. He says, My God shall supply all your need. My God, your need. And I had to think about this thing about how we often project God's power onto other people. And we pray for other people, and we issue platitudes to other people, how, you know, God will have to take care of them. And maybe we pray for the refugee crisis in Syria, or we pray for people who have suffered some natural calamity, and we claim to trust God to supply their need. I'd like to talk a little bit about how Paul could actually say this and have it be a fact, that or how he could be valid in saying this and not be as we too often are. Now, Paul himself has gone through enormous things. Or he went through so much for Christ in his ministry. And here he is in prison. I think he's earned the ability to make this statement, whereas I think a lot of us haven't earned it. My God shall supply all your need. I think we can say that if we are willing to do what we can to supply that need. Because so often we turn this thing around and we place ourselves firmly on God's side with no real evidence that we belong there. You remember that beautiful story in Exodus when the children of Israel have just fled out of Egypt and they're escaping. And here they turn around late in the day and they see this dust coming behind them, miles behind them, the desert sand being whipped into the air by those hundreds of chariots and Egyptian soldiers chasing after them to bring them home and enslave them again. And the children of Israel were terrified, and they said all these things against Moses. Have you brought us out here to die? And we should have just died there. And Moses says, "Stand still and see the salvation of the Lord." And darkness was falling as they came to the Red Sea. And says the angel of the Lord removed from the front of the camp. It came around to the back of the camp. And there was a pillar of fire on the side of the Israelites, so they could see as this great crossing was happening. They could see all night long in this pillar of fire. But what happened on the other side? It was a pillar of darkness. It was black darkness on the Egyptian side. They couldn't see anywhere. On the one side, fire and light. On the other side, darkness and cold. Which side do we belong on? God's people, aren't made such by only claiming allegiance to him, by mere lip service. How do we know that Cornelius was a devout man? It's because he ordered his life such. And he allowed huge upheavals into his life in his search for God. Do we allow huge upheavals into our life in our search for God? Or is it too much a thing of lip service for me? We're the children of God when he is our Father, when he's our Master, when he's our Lord. Where he sends us, we go. His compassion is ours. His truth gets no apology from us. Or needs no apology to us. His Spirit enlivens us and guides us. His grace enables us. And like the lepers that Jesus sent, we're healed in the going. We aren't just magically, mysteriously made God's people at some point in our life and then it's free sailing from there on. We are made his people in the going. We are healed as we go. There's a this psalm I'd like to look at that I think expresses this dichotomy so well. God's people versus the people who are against him. And it's found in Psalm 46. If you'd like to turn over there with me. Complacency is the enemy of God. Complacency is a good friend of unbelief. It needs to be our enemy. Okay, look at the split picture here in Psalm 46, if you will. God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. And aren't you so thankful that he is? He's our refuge and our strength. And he is. He has been to us, has been to me personally. Therefore will we not fear, though the earth be removed, and though the mountains be carried into the midst of the sea, though the waters thereof roar and be troubled, though the mountains shake with the swelling thereof. Selah, think on it. He's our protection. We don't need to fear anything when we have God on our side, when we are on God's side. No matter the difficulties we face, though the very earth splinter around us, like it says here, yet God is going to take care of his people. He will take care of you, his people. There's the river, the streams whereof shall make glad the city of God, the holy place of the tabernacles of the Most High. God is in the midst of her. She shall not be moved. God shall help her, and that right early. Israel is surrounded by arid lands. If you go onto Google Maps and look at an overhead view of a satellite view of Israel, you'll see this little greenish, not terribly green, but greenish patch along the Mediterranean Sea. To the south is barren desert. To the east is barren desert. To the west is the ocean. Just this little sliver of green crawling north. And when the Israelites talked about streams and rivers, they weren't Missourians. We're used to streams. We're used to rivers. We're used to springs and lots of water, lush greenness outside in the springtime. For them, rivers and streams were more than a nice, refreshing thing. They were the stuff of life. The river of life. God in the midst of her, symbol of the presence of God in a desert and in a hopeless environment. His blessing upon his people. Without him, they were nothing. They had to have him to sustain them. What a promise. God in the midst of his people, sustaining us, watching over us. He said he's not going to be late. He's going to help, and he's going to help right early, it says. He's never too late. And then we flip it around and we look at verse 6. The heathen raged. The kingdoms were moved. He uttered his voice. The earth melted. I thought he was a river. It says the earth melted. The Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our refuge. Selah. The picture is completely reversed for the enemies of God, for the enemies of his people. The earth melts for those people. The cloud is cold and dark for those people. God is a terrifying force to those who oppose him. Come and behold the works of the Lord, what desolations he hath made in the earth. He maketh wars to cease. Sounds good, right? Peace. Except what does it say? He breaketh the bow and cutteth the spear in sunder. Those are violent acts. Those aren't things that happen easily. He burneth the chariot in the fire. Once again, God's enemies are in a horrible place. I'd like to jump over here to Luke 20 and talk about and read something that Jesus was saying to the Pharisees, a story that he told them. It says, a certain man, this is in Luke 20, verse 9, a certain man planted a vineyard and led it forth to husbandmen and went into a far country for a long time. And at the season he sent a servant to the husbandmen that they should give him of the fruit of the vineyard. But the husbandmen beat him and sent him away empty. And again he sent another servant, and they beat him also and entreated him shamefully and sent him away empty. And again he sent a third, and they wounded him also and cast him out. Then said the Lord of the vineyard, what shall I do? I will send him my beloved son. Send my beloved son. And it may be they will reverence him when they see him. But when the husbandmen saw him, they reasoned among themselves, saying, this is the heir. Let us kill him, that the inheritance may be ours. So they cast him out of the vineyard and killed him. What therefore shall the Lord of the vineyard do unto them? He shall come and destroy these husbandmen, and shall give the vineyard to others. And when they heard it, they said, God forbid. And he beheld them and said, what is this then that is written? The stone which the builders rejected, the same is become the head of the corner. Whosoever shall fall upon that stone shall be broken, but on whomsoever it shall fall, it will grind him to powder. Who is he talking to? He's talking to the religious people of that day. And I don't think we need to necessarily align ourselves with the Pharisees, and yet maybe we enter too close to that picture in ways that we are uncomfortable with. We want to quickly distance ourselves from them. But think about it. They were people who had called themselves God's people for a long, long time. They were doing the things that they thought were right. But they were doing them, somehow God had fallen through the cracks in their religion. And it was the way that the things that they were doing without the help of God. God wasn't present in it anymore. The people of God are the people who not only have been directed by God in the past, but are the people who continue to be directed of God, who seek to understand, not just so that they can claim right doctrine, but they seek to understand so that they may obey, so that they can know how to order their lives. Think about Cornelius there again that we were studying about this morning. He wanted to understand, not just so he could have correct theology, but so that he would know what to do with his life. When people claim to be God's children without following him, they are potent stumbling blocks to God's purposes and to the ability of true seekers to find God. They're like counterfeits, claiming to be something they're not and bringing distress and discouragement to any who see them. What would have happened if Cornelius had gone to Ananias and Sapphira instead? Do you think he would have continued to search? I don't know. But the fact is, I think it happens. The people who seek with a true heart maybe sometimes run up against somebody who claims to be something they are not when it comes to the relationship with the Lord. And they see these inconsistencies, and they see, well, what about this and what about that? This person claims to be a child of God. Will we be called into account for this? I think we will. Love that verse in verse number 18. Whosoever shall fall upon that stone shall be broken, but on whomsoever it shall fall, it will grind him to powder. Any of you who have experienced a fall, you know how painful that can be. Whoever comes to God on God's terms, willing to be taught and willing to be used, that person is certainly going to be broken before he or she can be used. The pride, the impatience, the rough edges, the ulterior motives, the selfishness, these things will be slowly but surely purged from God's people. Maybe he has to work extra hard on some of us. I don't know. They're broken from the old form so that they may be remade into the likeness of God himself, changed from glory to glory, even as by the Spirit of the Lord. But the point is, you have a choice in that process. We can either resist, or we can allow him to mold us. We can make it hard for ourselves, or we can make it easier for ourselves. Whoever is going to fall on that stone shall be broken, but on whomsoever it shall fall, it will grind him to powder. Whoever tries to bypass God's way to seek personal agendas, whether it's in the church or anywhere else in your life, we're going to be ground to powder. These are Christ's words. God is a comfort to those who call on him. He's a terror to those who don't. Finishing out Psalm 46, be still and know that I am God. I will be exalted among the heathen. I will be exalted in the earth. The Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our refuge. Selah. Be still, it says. Can we be still? Stop our struggling. Stop our fighting. Stop our impatience. Allow God to work. He's God. He's in control. He's going to be exalted. He's a refuge to those who call on him. Don't be afraid. Don't worry. Allow him to have you, to use you, to change you. And yet we still must decide which side we're on. And it's so hard for us to see ourselves. I told you about that story that I read as a ninth grader. I've never done this before, and I've never heard it done before, but I'm going to read a story this morning during the opening. And I'd like you to play, there's four main characters here in this story. And I would like you just to think about where you would fall on the spectrum. And I know it's a parable, and as such, it has a bit of a caricature to it. And yet, maybe it's a little bit too uncomfortable for us, uncomfortable for me. Here it goes. Marge laid a bold palm on the side of the soup kettle, cold as she expected. Lifting the cloth from the cornmeal muffins, she tested them with the back of her hand, cold. A thread of a sigh escaped her as she turned on the stove under the soup and set the plate of muffins on the kettle lidwise. At 5:30, Milt had struggled out the lane in their senile Ford on his way to the store for candles for Ricky's birthday cake. 2 hours later, Ricky, fed, bathed, and pajamaed, had dropped off to sleep on the window seat, watching for the lights of his daddy's car wallowing up the lane. Marge had kissed the tip of his freckled pug nose as she carried him to bed. She whispered as she tucked him in, "Goodbye, little four-year-old. Tomorrow, you will be 5. That was over an hour ago. What could be keeping Milt? Happy as she and Milt were, preaching Christ to the people of Lonesome Creek, there existed a number of disadvantages to living there. That lane, for example. If they had a Jeep, getting in and out wouldn't be such a major achievement. But that Ford of theirs? More than likely, that's the cause of Milt's delay, Marge guessed. A flat, the starter stuck, or the gears are locked again. She enumerated the chronic ailments of the ancient vehicle. Marge busied herself with the frosting for Ricky's cake. She had told him there could not be a big gift for him this year. Nothing like the tricycle or the tool chest he had pointed out in the catalog. But she had promised him candles for his cake. At 5 minutes till 9, Milt walked in carrying his muddy boots. Milt, where's the car? Coddling the Ford up the lane without being heard was a stark impossibility. On dead man's? The Lord and I have been having adventures this evening. Let me wash up and I'll tell you as I eat, Milt suggested as he poured water from the tea kettle into the basin and reached for the soap sliver. Minutes later, as he ate, Milt told his story. First person I saw when I got to the store was Lurdy Billings and one of his boys, Joey, I think it was. There he stood, eating baked beans from a can with his pocket knife. Joey stood watching him, practically drooling. The youngster's elbows were sticking out of his sleeves. His overalls reached only halfway below his knees, no socks. Toes sticking out of one shoe and a jar rubber holding on the sole of the other. No socks? In this cold weather? Exclaimed Marge. Milt nodded. Seeing his hungry eyes, watching his father eat was bad enough. But when Lurdy bought a carton of cigarettes, that was the last straw. I bought a pint of chocolate milk and a pair of those heavy wool socks, gave them to him and walked out. That's just like you, dear. Marge laid a warm hand for a moment on Milt's arm. A smile lit Milt's fine dark eyes for an instant, but did not pass to his lips. Then he continued. Outside the store, Tobe was waiting to ask if he could ride down this way as far as the mouth of his branch. Of course, I said he could, and... Again, Marge laid a hand on Milt's arm. Was he as usual? Yes, he definitely was as usual, Milt replied, only more so. I had to practically lift him into the car. After he started up his branch, he fell three times before reaching the footlog. It was nearly dark, and the temperature was dropping fast. He'd never have made it home, so... So you tried to take him home and got stuck, Marge interrupted him. You should have known better than to attempt driving up Dead Man's Branch this time of year. I did know better, Milt smiled. It was a matter of trying to drive up or carrying Tobe almost bodily those 3 miles of mud. Besides, I had no light, and you know as well as I what chance there'd be of my walking him home. Yes, I know, Marge agreed. As it was, I did get him there all right. But coming back, you know the place. We've been stuck in that hole plenty of times. Marge nodded. Well, she's sitting there up to her axles. And getting out of that branch without a light took a little while. I'm late. So I see. Marge smiled a quick smile. Then she sobered and sat silent for a long time. Finally she spoke. Milt, you know what? No, what? We need a new vehicle. A Jeep station wagon, to be exact. At least something that doesn't get stuck in every other mud hole and stall for no sensible reason. Something that can carry 15 people to church without their having to be stacked three deep. I've written to the board, reminded Milt. But what are they doing? They can't possibly realize how badly we need something or they'd have done something long ago. Money doesn't grow on trees for the mission board any more than it does for us, Marge. Anyway, my God shall supply all your need, according to his riches in glory by Christ Jesus, quoted Milt. You believe that, don't you? Of course, but then, dear, there are no buts, interrupted Milt gently. For a moment, Marge sat with downcast eyes, brushing a crumb back and forth with her little finger. Then she looked at her husband and asked humbly, Milt, do you think I'll ever have a faith like yours? You already have more than I, in many ways, Milt answered, as he stood and began stacking his dishes. Come, let's get these dishes done. Then you go to bed so I can study my sermon. Marge pushed back her chair. Go to bed, nothing. I've got Ricky's cake to finish. You go study and I'll do the dishes. By the way, where are the candles? The candles? Milt's jaw sagged. I forgot all about them. I really did forget them, but I had only 2 cents left after buying that chocolate milk and those socks. Marge just stared at Milt. Then she turned and began doing the dishes. But the tears were dropping fast. Milt watched her helplessly for an instant. Honest, Marge, I'm sorry. Are candles so important to 5-year-olds? Marge nodded as she wiped her eyes in her sleeve. I promised him there'd be candles, because we can't get him the other things he wanted. All right, then. I'll go get him some, declared Milt. I can use some of my suit money. At that, Marge jerked a handkerchief from her apron pocket and blew her nose hard, all the while shaking her head decidedly. Nope, Milt, you are not going to conference in that old brown suit one more year. We aren't touching a penny of that suit money, candles or no candles. For a moment, Marge's eyes filled with tears again as she thought of her son's disappointment on the morrow. She brushed them away and said quietly, I'll try to make Ricky understand. I guess 5 years isn't too young to begin learning. That socks and milk for the Joey Billings of the world are always more important than the things that we want for ourselves, even birthday candles. Hannah Moyer gave the oyster stew a swirl or two with a spoon. The steam burned her hand, and she quickly replaced the lid. She wished Jonas wouldn't drive off so near to dinner time. At 11:30, he had gone downtown to the bank. That was almost 3 hours ago. What could be keeping him? Happy as she and Jonas were, retired from the farm, there existed disadvantages to living so leisurely in town. For example, the extra time that lay so heavily on their hands. More than likely, Jonas met one of our old farm neighbors, Hannah mused, and he must hear all about the latest farm machinery and cattle prices. Hannah enumerated Jonas's favorite topics of conversation. With no chores or work waiting for him, there really is no reason for him to hurry back. But I do hope he got to the bank before it closed. Hannah busied herself with the frosting for Sam's cake. Their youngest was 21 years old today, so he knew what his gift would be. When Elmer, their oldest son, had come of age, she and Jonas hadn't put candles on his cake. Instead, Jonas had gotten clean new bills at the bank. They had rolled them tightly and inserted them into the candle holders. $100 bill for each of his 21 years. Some years, that $2,100 had been hard to scrape together, as each of their 7 other children had come of age. But the Lord had blessed, and now she and Jonas wouldn't miss the money they were giving to Sam tonight. At 2:30, Jonas strode through the breezeway into the kitchen. Hannah looked up from the frosting. "Jonas, I didn't hear you drive up." Her husband laughed, a deep, pleased laugh. "How, when do you ever hear that Buick drive up?" he asked. "I've just about decided not to trade it in for a new one this year." "Just wait until you see the new models. You'll change your mind, as you do every year," surmised Hannah. "Where have you been?" "Wait till I wash up, and I'll tell you as I eat," suggested Jonas, as he turned on the hot water at the wash bowl. Minutes later, as he ate Hannah's hot oyster soup, Jonas told a story. "First person I saw in town was Ruff Jenkins." "Not the Ruff Jenkins used to come begging at the farm," Jonas nodded. Was he as usual?" "Yes, he was definitely as usual," Jonas replied. "I took him home for fear he'd get hit by a car or picked up by the police. He has the same hard luck story. Everyone is against him. No one will give him work because he takes a little drink now and then. No food in the house and the children crying for something to eat. So I stopped at a store and bought a box of groceries. It was less than $5 worth. But those children's eyes lit up like neon signs when Ruff staggered up the walk with that box." "That's just like you, dear," said Hannah. Jonas smiled. "Guess I could have bought them more, but you don't want to encourage them to become parasites." "Yes, I know," Hannah agreed, turning off the electric mixer. "The more you give, the more they sponge off you. After I got back to town, I met Brother Ezra on the street, and we got to talking. He's on the mission board now, you know. They want a new Jeep station wagon at the mission on Lonesome Creek, but the board has no money to buy them one. Was he hinting for you to make another donation?" Jonas shook his head. "No. In fact, he said if everyone in the congregation would give $500 as we had, they'd not have to refuse the mission workers what they need. No, I'm sure he wasn't trying to get any money out of me. Just wanted some advice, I guess." "What did you tell him?" "Well, in the first place, I said probably the car they had down there was good for a couple more years. The board picks money off the trees. At least some mission workers seem to think so, especially those young ones who never had a farm and don't know what it is to work for the money they spend. Then I quoted that verse, 'But my God shall supply all your need,' and told him if they actually needed a Jeep, they could depend on God supplying the need. That seemed to encourage him. He said he guessed they didn't have enough faith. Said he was going to call the board together and suggest they pray for more faith. I promised we'd pray, too, that more of our congregation would get a vision of missions that would affect their billfolds." Jonas stood and began stacking his dishes. "Come, let's get these dishes done. We can drive out to the farm for a while before Sam and the others come for supper." "All right," Hannah agreed. "You load them in the dishwasher while I finish this cake. By the way, where are the bills? I may as well put them on the cake now in case we get back late." Jonas's jaw sagged. "I forgot all about them. I really did forget them, but by the time I finished talking with Brother Ezra, the bank was closed anyway." Hannah just stared at Jonas for a minute. Then she turned and began icing the cake, but the tears were dropping fast. Jonas watched her helplessly for a moment. "Honest, Hannah, I'm sorry. Is fixing that cake with $100 bill candles so important to Sam?" Hannah nodded as she wiped her eyes in her sleeve. "Sam will be expecting it. Couldn't I just write him a check for the same amount?" Hannah jerked a handkerchief from her apron and blew her nose hard, all the while shaking her head decidedly. "No, Jonas, that wouldn't be the same. We had that kind of candles for all the other children, and I can't bear to have it otherwise for our last one." "All right, then. I can call the bank and try to explain. They'll tell me to come on down, and we'll give the money just to accommodate me, I'm sure. It seems to me Sam isn't too young to begin learning that you don't get everything you expect in life." "I know he isn't," Hannah admitted, "but I'd rather he start learning on something that isn't so important as these birthday candles." Stories like that make me uncomfortable because it's a little bit too close to home and the way I view the needs around me and the way I view myself as a child of God. And I guess I'm okay with being uncomfortable with that, because I think it should make me uncomfortable. But I shouldn't stay uncomfortable. Matthew 7, verse 13 through 23. I'd like to look at that quickly. "Enter ye in at the straight gate, for wide is the gate, and broad is the way that leadeth to destruction, and many there be which go in thereat, because straight or narrow is the gate, Narrow is the way which leadeth unto life, and few there be that find it. Beware of false prophets which come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly they are ravening wolves. Ye shall know them by their fruits. Do men gather grapes of thorns or figs of thistles? Even so, every good tree bringeth forth good fruit, but a corrupt tree bringeth forth evil fruit. A good tree cannot bring forth evil fruit, neither can a corrupt tree bring forth good fruit. Every tree that bringeth not forth good fruit is hewn down and cast into the fire. Wherefore, by their fruits ye shall know them. Not every one that saith unto me, Lord, Lord, shall enter into the kingdom of heaven, but he that doeth the will of my Father which is in heaven. Many will say to me in that day, Lord, Lord, have we not prophesied in thy name, and in thy name have cast out devils, and in thy name done many wonderful works? And then will I profess unto them, I never knew you. Depart from me, ye that work iniquity. I'm not intending in any way to suggest that we are not God's people, that the people that are sitting here are not, don't have a true and vibrant and real relationship with God. And yet I think we should be aware of the sides on which our weaknesses lie. And I think this is one of the places where our weaknesses can lie. And I just challenge all of us to allow Christ to work in our lives. It'd be real for us, not just lip service, not just something we talk about, not just showing up for church and listening to the sermons and doing this and doing that, but that Christ really has us, that he's got our lives and our hearts, and that what he wants, we want. His compassion is our compassion, and that he can work in our lives, that we allow him to chip and break those little pieces off of us that are keeping us back, allowing him to change us more and more into his likeness. Luke 12:48, the last part of that verse. For unto whomsoever has much been given, shall much be required. I think we've been given a lot. And how are we using that in our lives, in our walk with Christ? Shall we kneel for prayer?